Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before we get started, a reminder that KABU is in the midst of our fall pledge drive. KABU is commercial-free, volunteer-powered radio made possible by people like you. Help us reach our $55,000 fundraising goal. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. Power is at the core of the problems facing humanity. How have human beings, one species among millions, become powerful enough to threaten a mass extinction and disrupt the Earth's climate? Can we change our relationship with power to avert ecological catastrophe, reduce social inequity, and stave off collapse? These are the issues that energy and sustainability expert Richard Heimberg addresses in his new book, Power: Limits and Prospects for Human Survival. Today we talk with Richard, who is a senior fellow and energy analyst at the Post-Carbon Institute, about how we need to rethink and reshape our relationships to all the various shapes and forms that power takes if we are to survive as a species into the next century. Richard, welcome back to Locus Focus.
It's a pleasure to be speaking with you again, Barbara.
Well, we're going to talk today about your new book, Power. And before we start actually talking about that, I just wanted to throw out that I've had a quandary about how to even deal with discussion of this book, because it seems to me that it's actually a brief history of everything. And I was wondering if that was your intention when you set out to write this book.
Yeah, I mean, this book is really a summation of everything I've worked on in my whole career. And it's a big picture book, as you say, which I had trouble with that initially, finding a publisher, because apparently big picture books are not huge sellers these days. You know, I mean, we want to read the latest on, you know, the lowdown on what was happening in a Trump administration or whatever. But there haven't, I mean, aside from Sapiens, Yuval Noah Harari's book a few years ago, there haven't been many books that really try to take in sort of the whole human condition the way I did in this book.
Well, one of the things that was fascinating to me was kind of reading the geologic history, and, you know, starting basically with the amoebas, or even before that, the first forms of life on planet Earth, and how they use power to become the next form of life, but also just kind of going through all the different transitions, historical periods, and with this through line of power. So I wanted to start by talking about, how do you define power?
Right. Well, the English word power has many meanings, and in some languages, some of those meanings are shifted off to other words. But in English, and I played on this happenstance, linguistic happenstance in the book, in order to be able to, you know, cover more territory. But in the English word power, first of all, if you ask a physicist, power is the rate of energy transfer, and you can measure that in watts or horsepower or something like that. But then we use energy to do things. So the ability to do something is power, you know, the power of flight or the power of speech or something like that. But then there's also social power. So if you can get other people to do something, that's also a form of power. And in fact, there are two forms of social power. That's what I call horizontal social power, where we kind of join together spontaneously to accomplish something. Then there's vertical social power, where some people have control over others, maybe using, let's say, bribes or threats to get other people to do what they want them to do. So if power is, you know, using energy to do something, this kind of social power is the ability to get to use other people's energy, basically, to get them to do something. And then there are other kinds of power too, the power of ideas, the power of sexual attraction, which has had an enormous influence throughout evolution and human society and so on. But they all have to do with, ultimately, with energy and with doing something.
Well, a lot of people have kind of negative sense of the word power. They think of it's just basically people, some group of people, or one group, one person having power over others, and that's bad. How do you expand that concept to show that power is probably more of a neutral concept.
Right. Well, it depends on who you're talking to. You know, if you're talking to a physical scientist, in their mind, power is all about, you know, what can be measured with a, you know, with an electronic device, maybe, or the power of an asteroid, or the power of a cell, you know, and. You know, so here again we get to this ambiguity of the English word, but you know, if you start to see power in this more holistic sense, I think it's possible to get a broad view not only of human history but of biological evolution and how it's taken us to this point where we, just one species, are basically overpowering nature and the planet, and you get some sense of perspective on why this has happened and maybe, you know, what we can do about it.
Well, let's talk a little bit first about how we got to the point where sapiens actually started overpowering the planet.
Sure.
Before there were Homo sapiens, before there were even any Homo erectus at all, how did the power play into evolution and the development of life on this planet?
Right. Well, biologists recognize what's called the maximum power principle, and that simply describes the observed reality that an individual within a species or a species within an ecosystem that's able to use the most power has the greater likelihood of survival and reproduction. So in a sense, evolution is all about power. But then once you realize that, the question comes up, well, why hasn't there just been one species that's, you know, taken over the whole biosphere by using as much power as is available? And the reason is there are so many different ways of applying power, you know, with different modes of locomotion or sensory perception, big, small. And there are so many ecosystems, there are so many different situations in which to apply power, that the result is this immense variety of creatures within nature, within the biosphere.
You say, why hasn't one species just totally dominated the biosphere? But it looks like,
yeah.
In your book, you talk about this. I mean, it looks like it's happened.
Yeah, that's right.
Even though there are still hundreds of thousands of other species. So let's talk about how Homo sapiens got to the point where we are now just about on the brink of extinction for not just ourselves, but maybe a lot of life on the planet.
Yeah, well, it's a long story. And of course, it starts in the Pleistocene with the evolution of human abilities to use tools, to harness fire, to clothing is a type of tool. And then language, which is sort of the master technology, because language enables us to teach other people how to make and use tools. And language has shaped us in so many ways and empowered us in so many ways. It's hard sometimes to understand because we're so used to using language as you and I are doing right now. It shapes our consciousness. It shapes our view of reality. But it's certainly made us a far more formidable species than other animals that certainly communicate. Even plants communicate, and some of them do it quite prolifically, like parrots. And I keep chickens in my backyard, and they have different vocalizations for communicating how they feel and if they want something and so on. But human language uses these abstract sonic or other kinds of symbols and arranges them according to very specific rules of grammar. And by doing that, we're able to express complicated thoughts, thoughts within thoughts. We're able to ask questions. And that leads us in all kinds of different directions. We can ask questions like, how did we get here? What's the meaning of that? And, you know, the result of that was religion, among other things, which is just an accidental byproduct of language.
Well, actually, there's a lot of scientific evidence that other species, both plant and animal, do a lot of communicating.
Right.
And have, maybe you could call it language. I talked with Suzanne Simard, a forest ecologist, a number of months ago. She's been following the mother tree, basically,
yeah,
and discovering how all the trees in the forest communicate with each other. And it seems like it's a pretty complex kind of language. And then, of course, animals, I mean, crows in particular, corvids,
oh, yeah,
I mean, they really do communicate, and you can... I live around a lot of crows, as everybody in Portland does, and they have so many different sounds that I don't know, maybe their language is as complicated as ours. So how do we not know that other life forms are also communicating?
It's the abstract symbols, and it's the grammar, the ways of combining these symbols. There really isn't anything like it, as far as we know, in any other species. Certainly, you know, dolphins and whales have very complex ways of communicating, but so far we haven't found in their communication the kinds of sequences and rules that make human language the powerful mechanism that it is.
I'm thinking about the whale's ability to communicate with humans, which is interesting. 3 years ago, there was a whale named Tahlequah, a southern resident orca, who would come to the Puget Sound every year with her pod. And she had a baby, and the baby died. And the baby died because of the shortage of salmon, basically, and goes all the way back to all those dams on the Snake River and all these very interconnected things. So for, I remember how many days, maybe a couple of weeks, she swam around a broad reach of the Salish Sea with the baby on her back. And she was going to all these urban areas. She was going to Seattle and Tacoma, and I'm not sure if she got all the way down to Olympia, but she was communicating very clearly with the human species about what we were doing to them and to the rest of the planet. And I wonder, do you see that as maybe having similar kind of complexity to what, maybe on another plane higher than the way that we communicate?
Yeah, I mean, I think routinely we underestimate the communicative abilities of other species. And we're discovering more and more all the time about the amazing abilities of, as you say, corvids and parrots and even plants, in some cases, to communicate. But it's the abstract nature of human communication that really, I mean, we have words for things that don't physically exist, and we can combine those words in really complicated ways to, you know, write 1,000-page treatises and so on, and talk about things that don't exist, and talk about events, possible events in the future, or events in the distant past that, you know, long before we were born. Again, there's no evidence that other creatures are able to do that.
I wonder, though, if the abstract quality of our language is one of the things that actually separates us from nature.
Yeah.
In a very dangerous way, and has set up this problem that we are facing right now with us overpowering the earth and really devastating the natural world.
Yeah, absolutely. Language probably drove a wedge between the sides of our brain. You know, the one half of our brain, the left side in most people, is the more linguistic part of the brain, and the other part of the brain is always trying to get through, make itself understood, and sometimes that takes the form of visions or hearing voices. There have been lots of neurological experiments and case studies where this has been shown. So we've kind of driven ourselves a little crazy with our linguistic prowess. Language enables us to do things like lie, you know, and there's deception in the animal and plant kingdom, but there certainly isn't lying on the level that human beings are able to accomplish.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Kibbutz Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Richard Heinberg, who's author of Power, Limits and Prospects for Human Survival. Well, you mentioned there's two kinds of ways that power can structure itself, horizontally and vertically. So let's talk a little bit about the distinctions between those two structures.
Yeah. Well, horizontal human power was prevailing for tens of thousands of years as we lived in small groups of hunter-gatherers. Then gradually, through a process that I describe in chapter two of the book, we developed more complex societies, and the key seems to have been grain agriculture. And the reason for that is grains can be stored and therefore taxed. And so as population grew and there was more and more conflict between groups pushing up against one another, one of the survival strategies was to develop grain agriculture as a way of feeding more people on a relatively small piece of land. But then that led to the emergence of kings and cities. And so the first states appear something like 6,000-7,000 years ago. And these first states were organized around cities with writing, metal implements and weapons, kings, social specialization, so full-time specialists in the sacred, you know, priests and so on, and full-time scribes and craftsmen of various kinds, full-time soldiers. This had never really existed before. And these societies were themselves very formidable, and they were very successful in sort of conquering and enslaving the surrounding tribal peoples. All of these early state societies practiced slavery. And so this was kind of a rupture in human social evolution, this emergence of stark vertical power. This was a rupture that we've been trying to heal or trying to get beyond ever since in various ways, whether it's with, you know, democracy or constitutions or taxing the rich or whatever. All of these have been ways of trying to somehow return to a situation of more horizontal power where we were more equal. There was more of a sense of community and less of this vertical power over.
Well, as a sort of an aside, I had this indigenous friend who said many years ago that she didn't think that the rupture, the break from nature that humans experienced was really due to agriculture so much as it was due to the domestication of animals. And I'm just wondering what you think about that.
Yeah, well, that was certainly a big part of it. I discussed domestication quite a bit in the book. In some ways, we humans probably domesticated ourselves because indigenous people, everybody, all human beings, show many of the signs of domestication that have been well studied for many decades, going back to Darwin. But with the domestication of animals, we started applying the methods of domestication to one another on the basis of this, you know, vertical power that we were talking about before. So some people controlling other people's lives, reproduction, so on, in state societies based on cities. You know, cities were very unhealthy places. So in order to maintain the population within cities, they constantly had to import people from the countryside, whether it was war captives or children. And so women were enlisted and required to produce as many children as they possibly could, which kept them busy in the household doing women's work. The social status of women plummeted with the beginnings of state societies. And women and children became sort of household domesticates. just as, you know, artists and musicians and warriors were kind of, you know, domesticated humans available to the use of the king and the royalty.
One of the things that you talk about in the book is how the big shift, we call it the big acceleration or the great acceleration, when we started using fossil fuels. Yeah. And I know Andrew Nikiforuk, who's a writer in Canada, has talked about how the use of fossil fuels allowed each one of us to have our own slaves. We no longer had to enslave people.
Right, yeah. It's the concept of energy slaves. So, you know, if the services that are performed for each of us in, let's say, North Americans, if those services that are performed by, you know, our cars and TV sets and plugging stuff into the wall and all of that, if all of that had to be done with human labor, human muscle power, each of us would need somewhere between 150 and 300 slaves, right? So obviously we don't have human slaves in a formal sense anymore, but we get all this stuff done. It's miraculous, you know, it traces back to fossil fuels, which are completely different from anything that human beings knew before. Energy is everything. We can't do anything without energy. And the sources of energy that we had previously were, you know, food. And then we harnessed wind to a certain extent with sailboats and water. We had, there were water wheels and so on. But it was a pretty low energy way of life compared to what we've gotten used to with fossil fuels. They represent tens of millions of years of stored ancient sunlight, energy on a scale that is absolutely mind-boggling. And that's what's enabled us to grow our population by 800% in the last 200 years. And meanwhile, our per capita rates of consumption have also grown by 800%. So we human beings have become immensely powerful compared to what we were, you know, just a couple of centuries ago because of fossil fuels.
Well, does that answer one of the questions that you raised in the beginning of the book, is how did this one species come to dominate the Earth the way it did and overpower everything else?
Yeah, well, I mean, we got to start with, you know, language and tool-making ability and clothing and so on. We were already kind of taking over the planet. We were driving some species extinct long ago, you know, when people first arrived on the Pacific Islands, for example. They killed the moas and all kinds of big animals. And here in North America as well, mastodon, mammoth. So human beings were already powerful, but fossil fuels supercharged us. So just, you know, just in the last couple of hundred years, the rate of species extinctions has accelerated dramatically. And just about any other way of managing or changing or impacting the Earth has similarly, you know, just gone off the charts.
Well, one of the things that's really very striking is the inequities that the system has created. But what I was really interested in your book was this chart that you showed the income inequality over time. And it seems like in, I think it was the 14th century, well, prior to all the horrible things that happened in the 14th century, that there was probably worse income inequality than there is in the United States now. And that also in the 1920s, there was more income inequality than there is now. So how do you explain that kind, those kind of forces?
Right. Well, that kind of inequality really started, again, back in the early state societies. We created what I like to call a wealth pump. So with taxation, the wealth of society tended to flow up the social pyramid to, you know, the king, his family, his retainers, and so on. And then ever since then, you know, whenever a person or a group has highly unequal, outsized social power, they tend to use that power to change the rules of society so that they get even more power. And so this wealth pump constantly generates inequality. And this has been studied by historians and sociologists, especially just over the last few years, quite extensively. And what it does is it creates social instability. So when inequality grows to real extremes, then what typically happens is a revolution, an economic collapse, or a war. And that tends to level things out again for a while until the wealth pump gets going again. And we even saw that in the 20th century. As you mentioned, back in the 1920s, there was a tremendous income inequality in the United States. And then with World War, well, actually starting in World War I, but then especially through the Great Depression and World War II and its immediate aftermath, wealth and income inequality in the U.S. plummeted. And it wasn't necessarily just because of, well-meaning progressive income tax and redistribution and so on. Those things were going on, but it was mostly just because all of society's resources had to be enlisted in overcoming these huge threats. And then after World War II, now we've had, 70 years of relative peace, and the wealth pump has had a chance to get going again. And now we're seeing, right now we have something like 7 people in the world, billionaires who control as much wealth as the poorer half of humanity. Now, just in terms of wealth inequality, there's probably never been anything like this situation in all of human history.
Well, one of the big differences, it seems, between now and back in the 13th and 14th centuries is how global everything is, which is something else that you talk about. You call it this a superorganism.
Yeah.
But let's talk about the dangers of globalism.
Right. Well, the idea of the superorganism is not mine. A number of students of social evolution, let's say, have come up with the idea that, as super social organisms like human beings develop, they create a kind of super organism. An anthill is kind of a super organism. Even though they're each individual organisms, they all make up a larger whole that sort of makes decisions together and uses resources together and so on. And we human beings are a super organism too. Only we're a global superorganism. This wasn't the case in centuries past. It's really just, again, probably since roughly the end of World War II, that we have become a global economy that's tied together by almost instantaneous communication, resource usage and sharing. I mean, we're talking to each other right now by way of, computers and smartphones and so on. No, there's no country in the world that can manufacture one of these things all by its lonesome. The resources come from one continent, then they're shipped to another continent to be processed into, more sophisticated resources that get shipped someplace else to get manufactured into a device that gets shipped to yet another country for packaging. And then, it may end up with an end user on, a fourth or fifth continent. We have this global economy, depending on global communications, is really a new thing in human history. And it makes it really hard to solve many of our social and ecological problems because there's nobody in charge of it. There's no global government that in charge of the superorganism. So if we realize, for example, that we're changing the climate, we're putting future generations in peril, well, who do you go to complain? Well, there's the United Nations, sure, but it's a relatively toothless organization. It can't actually force its member states to reduce their carbon emissions by a certain percent or whatever. It's all voluntary, and countries get together every year or three or four to try to figure this out. But so far, it's not going that well.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on Kibwe Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN, and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Richard Heinberg, author of Power, Limits, and the Prospects for Human Survival. And I just want to remind you that Kibwe is in the midst of our fall pledge drive. We're commercial-free, volunteer-powered radio made possible by people like you. And you can help us reach our $55,000 fundraising goal by just going to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. And thanks for supporting community-powered radio. Actually, this kind of makes me think about the difference between KBOO and the corporate media. And I wonder if you see some parallels. I mean, KBOO is like really, in a lot of ways, people-powered as opposed to CNN, let's say. And how do you see like your understanding of power working in describing both of these different kinds of organizations?
Well, in the book, I talk about institutional power. And of course, we've had institutional power even since before the early state societies I've been talking about. But institutions in ancient times were pretty informal and small scale. As institutions become larger and more formalized, they take on a life of their own. And the people who work in or run organizations develop, sort of superhuman power, because when they act, they're acting not just on behalf of themselves as individual humans with wants and desires and vulnerabilities and so on, but they're acting as agents of the institution. And many of our institutions have just grown so big and so powerful that they run roughshod. They have their own institutional survival priorities, their growth priorities that overwhelm the interests really of the community around them. So one of our tasks, if we're going to survive this century, I think is to break up many of these institutions and downsize them, relocalize our economies, and create institutions that have more level power or horizontal power as opposed to vertical power, where it's some people making all the decisions and influencing everybody else with threats and bribes. So something like community radio fits this description perfectly. You know, it's a situation where people get together to further their shared interests in ways that are voluntary and cooperative and usually involve a lot of volunteerism. And, you know, there are drawbacks to that. Typically, those kinds of institutions aren't as powerful as some of the, you know, big multi-million or billion-dollar organizations that they may be competing with. But again, you know, it depends on what kind of future we're going to want to have, or if we want to have a future.
I was thinking while I was reading your book about when I was younger, when I was a young hippie and basically lived in a community of other young progressive hippies. And we thought we were basically creating a new world. And we live so far away from so much of the corporate world that it didn't really touch our lives. And we did sometimes drive cars, not that much usually. We mostly rode bicycles. We grew not all of our own food, but we were all trying to learn how to be gardeners at that point. And culturally, we were basically listening to our own music. We were listening to KBOO here and listening to all the other community stations that are around the country. And I remember waking up some point, I think it was late 1981, and I realized in those early days of Ronald Reagan that the revolution hadn't happened.
Yeah.
And it was really depressing.
I know.
So
yeah.
I think what I'm thinking about now, if we're going to move forward, that we can't be so isolated from the main body of humanity in this world, that we need to tap into larger groups of people than just our own immediate circle of friends.
Yeah. Maybe we were ahead of our time. I don't know, but the time has certainly come. I don't know if you saw that survey that was just released, done by a university in Britain. It came out just a couple of days ago, showing that a majority of young people around the world, they surveyed, I think, 10,000 young people in 10 different countries, and a majority of young people believe that humanity is doomed. Three quarters of them think that the future is going to be horrific. Unfortunately, with our current direction, they're right. And that's an indication of just abject failure on the part of our generation. Now, surely, you know, some of us have been more responsible for that failure than others. I like to think that, you know, those of us who went back to the land and grew our own food and had all these idealistic hopes maybe haven't contributed as much as some others, but nevertheless, on the whole, you know, we screwed up. And unless we get it together soon, and I'm not just talking about our generation, but all of humanity, I'm afraid that the fears of young people are going to be realized.
Yeah, I heard about that poll too the other day, and it's one of the things that set me thinking, because I was still in the midst of reading your book too, about this seems like the inability for humanity, as we know it, to follow through in the pursuit of a world that's good for everybody. And I mean, you think about Donald Trump, and how did that happen that we had this guy as president? Why do we have dictators all around the world? And then it keeps bouncing me back to the 14th century, because I started the pandemic a year and a half ago reading Barbara Tuchman's book, A Distant Mirror, to read about a time that was even more messed up than the time we were living in. And also, I was interested in learning more about the Black Plague. So it was, you know, living in the time of pandemic. But it was really horrifying to learn just all the in-depth about that century. Besides the Hundred Years' War, which I knew vaguely about, to see how much cruelty there was. And then at the end of that century, because there was so much death and there were a lot of things that opened up, and some people think it was what led to the Renaissance, which also wasn't that great a thing for many, many people. But it made me wonder what it takes for us to shift out of this place of cruelty and self-interest and vertical power and start thinking about things that really work, that would really serve everybody on the planet.
Well, ultimately, what we have to do is limit our own power as a species. And that sounds almost impossible, because we all know that people who are very powerful tend to fight back against any limits to their power. Nevertheless, as I show in the book, there's a long history of, first in nature itself, of power self-limitation. But also in human societies, going back to, again, when we were hunters and gatherers, and all the way up to the present, democracy, constitutions, progressive taxation. We've always recognized the peril of too much power and how it can make human societies not just unfair, but also unstable. And so we found ways of moderating power. The problem we have in the modern world is with fossil fuels, we've gained so much power so fast that we've developed this illusion, this misapprehension that somehow there are no limits. And you hear people say this, there are no limits to human ingenuity. There's no limit to economic growth. You know, we're going out to the stars. We're going to take over other planets. Well, unfortunately, that's pure hubris. And in fact, if we're going to survive, we're going to have to reduce our land use, reduce our carbon emissions, reduce our use of energy, reduce economic inequality, which means that some human beings who are very wealthy are going to have to give up a lot of that wealth and spread it around. And that means, you know, giving up power. So can it be done? In principle, yes. But this is the ultimate power struggle that we're living through in this century. And when we see tyrants and forces of the far right taking over, in whether in this country or in Europe or other countries, reliably, it's people who speak for the interests of entrenched power who refuse to give up some of that power for the sake of the rest of society, the rest of humanity, the rest of nature. They want to hold on to it. And that's the struggle that we're in.
Well, you mentioned that there's self-regulating kinds of things that happen in systems so that one group or one individual doesn't have too much power. And it's clear, I think of FDR as being a great example of the United States had gone over too deeply into this very divided society and with many, many have-nots and just a few haves, and that he basically saved capitalism for at least the time being. And I think that Lyndon Johnson did the same thing in a lot of ways. But how much does that really help? And are those just kind of band-aids that are just putting off a really horrible future?
Right. Well, up to now, the examples that you cited were kind of band-aids, and they worked up to a point. If FDR hadn't done what he did, there was real concern among the ruling class in the United States that there would be a communist revolution in this country, but there wasn't. Partly because the capitalist class was persuaded that it was in their interest to spread the goodies around a little bit more. But now we're in a situation where sort of half measures like that aren't going to be sufficient. The ruling class of today hopes that all we have to do is build a few solar panels and wind turbines, and we'll be able to take care of climate change and basically keep the economy growing. In fact, if we build enough solar panels and wind turbines, that'll create jobs and more economic growth, and the rich will get even richer. As I discuss in the book, there are very, very good reasons for thinking that that's simply not the case, that renewable energy by its very nature is not going to be able to replace fossil fuels in the way that fossil fuels currently serve us. And what that means is we're not going to be able to solve climate change just by replacing energy sources. We're actually going to have to reduce the scale of our energy usage and give up doing some things that we're currently doing. Maybe commercial aviation is something that just won't be possible in a post-fossil fuel world. Well, maybe a lot of us would hate to see that go. And, it's pleasing and convenient to be able to hop on a plane and go for a vacation or visit relatives and so on. But, considering what's at stake, the planet, future generations, it may be just a price we have to pay. As we learned with the pandemic, commercial aviation was basically shut down for several months so that we could save ourselves from a plague. Well, there's an even bigger plague called climate change, and it's going to require a lot of adaptation on our part.
Well, I wonder how much you think that the pandemic has maybe reshaped some people's values and their way of thinking about what they're doing. I know for myself, I was a frequent flyer. Actually, I stopped doing it a few years before the pandemic. But I used to fly around a lot and feel guilty about it, but it was what I needed to do for my work and for family reasons. Now, the last thing I want to do is get on a plane. And when I think about the future, there's still a couple trips I'd like to take, but they really have gone way down in my priorities.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, the pandemic has raised all sorts of issues and questions, one of which has to do with social cohesion. Because we've seen that the societies, the countries with more social cohesion have generally done better with the pandemic than those without. Countries where everybody can be, can easily buy into the idea of getting vaccinated or wearing a mask, the rate of transmission just plummets. And other countries where people are at each other's throats, saying, well, do masks don't work? Vaccinations are, it's a form of tyranny and all of this sort of thing. Well, we pay the price. And it's going to be the same thing with this, the matter of giving up power that we've been talking about. If we as nations, as societies, understand what's at stake and are willing to sacrifice some of our power with the trust that others are doing so too, and that we'll all be better off in the end as a result, things are going to go much better. But if societies fragment and some people see power sharing or power sacrificing efforts as being unfair or some kind of conspiracy, then it's not going to go well at all. And, you know, sadly, I think our country is on the latter path. And somehow we have to turn that around if we're going to get through this together.
Well, one little bit of hope coming from your state of California is that Gavin Newsom was not recalled just last night.
And
it was interesting that I was reading a statistic that California has one of the highest vaccination rates in the country, and that Newsom ran on a campaign about, don't you want to have vaccine mandates? Don't you want to have mask mandates? Don't you want to stop the COVID pandemic? And the idiot who was running against him was exactly the opposite. So does that give you some hope there?
Well, yeah, but it's... I think what we're seeing is the country is fragmenting geographically. And how this ends, I don't know. I mean, will the United States cease to exist as a unified political entity at some point? That sounds extreme, but it's conceivable. I mean, if we're unable to get beyond these regional political polarizations, then we're going to have to find ways of reorganizing so that we can get things done. I mean, things have to be done. We're in a survival situation. And if we can't pull together and do what's required to enable nature and future generations to survive, then, you know, that's it.
On that happy note, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN, and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Richard Heinberg, author of Power, Limits and Prospects for Human Survival. Well, in the last part of the show, I want to talk about the positive side of power and how, because you, at the end of the book, you have different scenarios for what we can do, and we just touched a little bit about it. But how do you see the kinds of power we can turn to and really try to expand upon that are really good for us?
Right. Well, we've already talked about horizontal power, and I think there already are a lot of activist groups, nonprofits, pulling in generally the right direction to reduce unhealthy concentrations of power, whether it's social power or economic power or physical power in terms of, you know, weapons control, carbon emissions, economic inequality, all of these things. There are people working on all of them. They have to get together. You know, we all have to pull in the same direction and recognize that even though, you know, I may have a different personal interest than somebody else who's working on one of these other issues, we got to get beyond our silos and pull together. Unfortunately, the way the nonprofit world and the foundation world work tends to keep those silos pretty strong because, you know, nonprofits are constantly having to compete with each other for foundation dollars, and foundations are only willing to give out their money on the basis of what they make each year in terms of returns on their investments. So the economy has to grow in order for the whole foundation system to work. All of this is dysfunctional. We gotta reorganize that. But then looking further out in, you know, possible human evolution in future decades or maybe future centuries or even millennia, I think there's a possibility that we could create a different kind of society based more on beauty than wealth and political and military power. And that sounds, you know, almost absurdly idealistic, but I think there's a grounding for it in evolution itself, because evolution produces beauty. Sexual selection is all about, you know, animals, plants competing with each other to see, you know, who can be most attractive. So nature is intentionally beautiful. The daily activity of of plants and animals is largely expended not just in survival and getting food, but also in producing beauty. Same with human beings. We're very good at it. We've got art and music and architecture and literature and poetry and humor and jokes. You know, all of this is wonderful, but so much of it has been hijacked by capitalism. You know, we suffer from aesthetic decadence because our aesthetic sensibility has been enlisted in consumerism, which is driving us off the cliff. If human creativity were unleashed from this harness and enabled to return to the service of the community, I think we could have an incredibly beautiful future, and people could spend much of their lives devoting themselves not to, you know, serving the corporation and making a paycheck and making money, but actually making the world an even more beautiful place than it already is.
I'm thinking about this song that the Bobs did a number of years ago. I think it was during the crash, one of the crashes, maybe in the late 80s or the dot-com crash or something. And the song was, "Once I was a hippie, then I was a stockbroker, now I'm a hippie again." And I wonder, in a way, I'm thinking about my hippie days, and there's lots of stuff I wouldn't want to go back to there because I think I know a few more things and have a little bit more empathy and understanding and a much more broader sense of diversity than I had then. But there were some values, these core values about what was important. And I wonder, how do we really jump onto those and stay focused on that despite all the distractions? And one side thing, I mean, like the last summer after George Floyd was murdered and people came out by the millions and hundreds of millions to protest and to really understand what racial justice and injustice is. And a lot of people commented that it was because the pandemic had taken away our distractions. So I wonder if this is something we're still in the pandemic, unfortunately, a year and a half later. Do you see that there are ways that we can free ourselves from the distractions and maybe take the time that we still have during the pandemic to look in a different direction?
Yeah, well, I think we have to daily remind ourselves of just what's at stake and what's happening. It's so easy to get, I soothe myself in various ways. I distract myself with denial. We all do it, you know, just as a way of protecting our fragile psyche in the face of, you know, climate change and all the rest. Okay, and some of us need to do that more than others just because we are more psychologically fragile, maybe. But the adults in the room, those of us who have the capacity to do so, really need to focus on this and take the bit in our mouth and run with it. You know, when we hear from Greta Thunberg, when she says that, the leaders of the world are lying to themselves and to us by, you know, just worshiping constant economic growth rather than coming to grips with the reality. You know, that's a young person who's seeing things for what they are and saying things that we should all be saying. No magic bullet, easy answer here, but it's we've got to take this much, much more seriously than we've done so far.
Do you think if Biden's infrastructure plan, the big one, the $3.2 trillion or whatever it is plan, were that to be passed, do you think that that would help to move us in the right direction?
Well, it's definitely better to do it than not to do it. But, you know, we're still thinking in terms of more economic growth. We're still thinking in terms of, switching out gasoline cars for electric cars. We're still thinking of changing out coal power plants for solar panels. Those are good things up to a point. But the reality is it's our whole way of life that's driving us off the cliff. It's the way we've organized a consumer economy that has to grow or die. It can't keep growing. We're pushing up against ecological limits, not just climate limits, but resource limits, pollution land use, taking space away from other species. In all of these ways, we have to pull back. And that's the message that finally has to get through.
So, do you have any final words on how we get that message through?
Well, that's what the book is about. And I don't have any illusion that one book is going to, you know, save the world. But if I'm saying it, there must be other people out there who are seeing this and saying it too. And hopefully it can light a little fire that can join with some other people's, you know, little fires, and we can do something together.
Well, Richard, thanks so much for talking with us today. It's great to have you on Locus Focus.
It's a pleasure, Barbara. I always enjoy talking with you.
We've been talking with Richard Heinberg, author of Power, Limits and Prospects for Human Survival. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO in the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us now during our fall pledge drive by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week, we'll talk with Danita O'Rourke with 350 PDX about a new study that reveals the real dangers of methane. We'll go out with some music by Joni Mitchell. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance when necessary and wear a mask.
Seagulls come down and they squawk at me, down where the water skiers glide. Some turn to Jesus and some turn to heroin, some turn to rambling round, looking for a clean sky and a drinking stream. Some watch the paint peel off, some watch their kids grow up, some watch their stocks and bonds, waiting for that big deal, American dream. I took my dream down by the sea, Yankee hats and lobster pots and sunshine and logs and sails and shell oil pails, dogs and tugs and summertime.